Good afternoon. You are tuned into Juno Afternoon here on Monday, the 11th of April, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown. I'll be your host for today. We'll get details about this month's Aware Self-Defense class offered. Peggy Metcalf will be here to highlight the volunteer program at the Pioneer Home. Lori Klein will be here to highlight a UAS film. We'll talk about Sitka's Roger Smith about this summer's Arts and Science Festival. And Peter Bradley will be on the line to talk about the Island Institute for Fairy Tour. At Writer's Almanac, Myrna, music and more to the end of Juno Afternoon. With the forecast for the rest of today, cloudy skies, numerous rain showers. Forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with scattered rain showers, low temperatures around 40 degrees. And the forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain, high temperatures around 50 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A First Nation community has declared a state of emergency over the soaring rate of suicide attempts by young people. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, leaders in the remote community in northern Ontario say they're overwhelmed by the numbers and the lack of resources to cope.
The Attawapiskat First Nation on the shores of James Bay has a population of about 2,000. Like many other remote Aboriginal Canadian communities, it's been plagued by suicides. This time, however, the situation became so critical that Chief Bruce Shishish signed the emergency declaration. He says there have been 11 suicide attempts this month alone, 28 in March and 100 since September, most of them young people. Native leaders say the reserve faces high unemployment, drug abuse, overcrowding, and during the long winter months, there's little for young people to do. Shishish says his community is in despair.
They're breaking down emotionally, unable to think, and they forget easily, unable to sleep properly. Their eating habits are not normal. Their high stress level.
The latest round of suicide attempts came after a 13-year-old girl took her own life in October. Many of her friends and family were grieving but didn't have the support they needed. The Member of Parliament for the region says many northern Indigenous communities aren't given the resources to deal with these kinds of issues. He calls it a systemic crisis. The federal and Ontario governments have promised help, and the regional First Nations Health Authority is flying in a crisis team that includes mental health nurses and social workers. Last month, a northern Manitoba First Nation also declared an emergency after 6 suicides in 2 months and 140 attempts in 2 weeks. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Kainaitse Indian tribe in Alaska recently opened a new elder center in Kenai. Officials say it's part of a larger strategy to restore an original village site and bring better services to people in the area. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
The Elder Center, which was built with funds from the Indian Health Service, opened in March. It's part of their development of the Kainaitse campus in Old Town Kenai. Jaylene Peterson-Nyrene is executive director for Kainaitse Indian Tribe. She says taking care of elders is a core Native value, so the project was a high priority for the tribe.
I like to say that we are all elders in the making when you really think about it.
Peterson-Nyrene says it's part of a plan for the tribe to be more proactive and visible.
The Dena'ina people on their land here on the Kenai Peninsula really became invisible in a way with all of the outside influence and other peoples coming in. And what we've tried to do is really partner well with the community.
Peterson-Nyrene says the development of the Kainaitse campus creates a sense of community that is both practical and also symbolic.
This is one of the original village sites where folks fish down in the dipnet fishery.
William Segura, who once worked in the local fishery, says he was born 71 years ago across the street from where the new Elder Center now stands. He says he's there for the socializing.
We never had nothing like this before, you know. I like it. I like to visit.
The elders had always advised the tribal council that they would like to return to the site, says Peterson-Nyrene.
We coined a phrase when we moved into the Dena'ina Wellness Center, and the term in Dena'ina is Nakanturalosh. Nakanturalosh means that the tide has been going out and away from us for many, many years, including our people and our culture. And now the tide has turned and is coming back into us. We are coming back to ourselves in this space, in this time.
A grand opening celebration for the Kainaitse tribe's new Elder Center is planned for June. I'm Daisha Eaton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Mm. National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to June Afternoon. We have two guests in the studios here to talk about things going on as part of the Sexual Assault Awareness Month. In the studios, Britta Thomason and Lori Klein. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Diana Stevens.
Sorry about that. There's a class that you're offering on self-defense. Can you tell me a little bit about why self-defense is needed for women?
Well, all women, I think, should know self-defense. It helps you to be relaxed and go about your life and to be independent. The things that we really focus on for women is awareness. Really, a lot of it is based on awareness, how to stay out of situations, if you're in a situation, how to get back out of the situation, those type of attitudes and things that you can do, such as small things like having your keys in your hand before you ever step out of your car to go to your house, or, you know, have your keys in your hands before you ever go to your car. Those simple sort of things are all part of self-defense, just being aware of what's going on around you, making choices. And then there is the physical side of it, of course, which we do a lot of. We have about 9 or 10 scenarios that we put you in, partner you up, and then you physically get out of them. And we show you, we demonstrate techniques, we build patterns so that you can see that every single scenario has somewhat of the same pattern. And what we're trying to do is incorporate things into women's psyche so that if something happens, it's there for them. They haven't forgotten at least something. They have something in their back pocket so that they can be move forward.
You have to have an immense amount of strength. Is that part of
The strength part? Well, it's not really about strength. There's, of course, men are stronger than women, and we're very aware of that. So what I like to say is that we're never going to be stronger than men, so we have to be smarter. And so there are all kinds of weapons that we have built into us, our feet, our elbows, our hands are, and so the approach is to react very quickly and to get away from the situation as fast as you can.
Is there any difference between the self-defense for men versus women?
I would say only an attitude. I teach just women's self-defense intentionally because I've been working with AWARE for a long time, and so it's my choice to teach women. But I would say self-defense is self-defense in a lot of ways.
What's the first thing you tell people when they walk into your studio?
Well, I teach karate in the studio, but again, it's attitude. There's a lot of attitude that goes along with karate, too. It's very disciplined, and self-defense also requires a certain amount of discipline in order to incorporate it into your life and have it there so that it's there for you, but you don't have to walk around being paranoid all the time. You just incorporate it. And so that would take a certain amount of thought, a certain amount of going back and looking at things again and again.
These classes are scheduled for April 23rd from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 p.m. How many things can you go over in that short amount of time?
Well, it's been really nice because the last few years, AWARE has actively partnered with me. And that's really great because they have so much information that they can present, and it's different from mine. What you can do. Well, Britt is going to talk about that in a few minutes, but so there are about 10 situations that we put people into. We partner them, and then they go over them, and then we are always switching you with partners. We don't want you to be comfortable, and we want you to be working with all kinds of different bodies and personalities and so forth. So at the end of the seminar, you've worked with every person there, and, you know, maybe a second time you've worked with them. But it's all about being always on your being caught off guard sort of thing, and having to get back out of it. But they are structured, and like I say, we do have patterns that we build into each one of them so that every woman can take it. It doesn't matter if you know self-defense or you've ever taken it or you haven't taken it. It doesn't matter. We've taken all of that into consideration. Plus age. It's age 14 and above. So, you know, if you're in, you have arthritis and you've gotten older, you have other sorts of handicaps, you can still take this. We, over the years, have taught people that have bad backs or people that are in wheelchairs and so forth, because there's always something that you can get out of a class like this and still use it.
Is it a cost?
$10.
How do people sign up?
I think Britt has got that information on signing up and so forth.
Hi, yes. So it's a pleasure to be here. AWARE is happy to support Diane in this event for self-defense during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is April. People can sign up for the event either by registering at AWARE or Kristen Mabry at Mountainside Wellness, where the event will be held, will also offer a link to registration on her website. The location is in the Arctic Corps building above the Charter School on the block in between the Cathedral and Holy Trinity in downtown Juneau. And as Diane was saying, and you had questioned some other things that AWARE will contribute and that this course will cover, are conversations about bystander intervention and what consent is.
Tell me more about bystander intervention.
So we've seen in many of the international events, especially with terrorism, that people who get involved that aren't directly in the conflict have a significant impact on the reduction of the impacts of the conflict on the people. And so there are very simple things that we can do as bystanders that we can do and maintain our own safety and comfort, as well as being able to intervene and possibly help. So that can look like very different things. It can look like running out of the grocery store saying, "Have you seen my husband?" when you see a couple in a conflict, to actually engaging and calling the police or something more serious. So we'll talk about that.
Is that part of the class then?
It's, from what I understand, I've never taken the class, but it is a portion of the class.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Sure. It's come dressed comfortably, sweats and a t-shirt, something like that, and bring lots of water. It's really, we've really geared it for everybody, but you will be tired at the end of it. So do expect that, you know, you're probably not going to want to go at dancing after you finish the course.
And we are expected to bring lunch, correct?
Yes, and please bring lunch, and we prefer you to eat there because we only have about a half hour break, and we find that if you stay there, then everybody's ready to go right on time.
And once again, how do people get in touch with you to register?
They can contact us at AWARE at 586-6623, or they can log on to mountainsidewellness.com and get a link to the registration there.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
about 16 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest, actually, same guest we had last half, as part of the show, Brenda Dawson, and also in the studio is Lori Klein. Thanks. Welcome back. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks, Jeff.
You want to go with a little bit more on Sexual Assault Awareness Month, please?
Yes, thank you for the invitation. So as many of you might know, we started the month off with our Children's Advocates Project, the Clothesline Project, which you might have seen at the Heritage Coffee in the Baranoff. It will shortly be put on display at the University of Alaska Southeast from the 11th, today, through the 20th, 21st or 22nd, and then it will be displayed on the 8th floor State Office Building atrium. And this project is really to bring awareness to the experience of women or men who have experienced women who have lived through domestic violence or sexual assault. So that has started us off. As we mentioned, self-defense, which will allow us to explore women in particular, the ability to set boundaries and to say no. And then Lori and I will continue talking about The Hunting Ground, which is a documentary on the experience of women and men with sexual assault while studying at universities.
Lori, you want to talk about The Hunting Ground, please?
Sure. The university will be having our first screening of The Hunting Ground on the Juno campus this Thursday, the 14th at 6:30 p.m., in conjunction with a number of community and campus partners. This film, as Britta said, is it's a documentary film kind of showcasing student activism on campus. These students were survivors of sexual assault, and they were unhappy with their university's response to their reports. This was happening over the last several years, and what it's done, and it's brought national attention to how colleges are responding to students who report assaults or harassment on campus. And we find ourselves in a different place now on university campuses, not just being responsive, but creating an environment where students feel safe and responded to when they report, and bringing more focus to awareness and prevention of assaults happening in the first place.
How long should people expect the film to be?
We're going to show the 40-minute version of the film. The full feature film is an hour and 40 minutes, but what we want to do is make sure we give good attention to the discussion that we're going to have afterwards. So we're having a 40-minute film, a short break, and then a discussion with campus and community partners to sort of debrief the film and make sure folks have a chance to express their thoughts and their feelings and have a community discussion about this issue. Sexual assault is not something that just happens on college campuses, although we know that oftentimes more than 80% of students who have this experience don't report. But it is a community, it's a statewide issue, and so we're opening up this screening to all of Juno and inviting everyone to come out.
I know that sexual assault is a problem everywhere. Is UAS any different or a normal place?
I think we'd be foolish to assume that we were. I think we have assaults and harassment, sexual assaults and gender-based harassment and sexual misconduct that takes place on our campus. We get reports every year. We respond to them. We're working very closely with our community partners now to put more efforts into awareness and prevention. But to assume that we're different than the college campuses showcased in this documentary, I think that would be incredibly short-sighted of us.
If I may add, one of the really great things that Lori has done with this film and UAS is there's a two-hour version, but there's also the 45-minute that she mentioned, and this is really going to allow us to open up a discussion of what this issue looks like here in Southeast Alaska, and the video really speaks to the woman's experience, and the man's experience with sexual assault, and so we're going to be able to explore that and kind of debrief what we see and what we hear and what we know to be true in our community. And so that's going to be a wonderful opportunity.
Is there anything in particular that a woman should do, be a student or not, once they've experienced sexual assault?
Well, we want everyone who's experienced an assault to know that there's help. There's resources available to them. They are not alone. We don't ever want anyone to feel like they can't reach out and get assistance. AWARE and the advocates at AWARE are incredibly resourceful, knowledgeable about other options. Victims have the opportunity to report to police or not. They have the opportunity to engage with an advocate or not. We encourage anyone who has been harmed to seek medical attention, and the hospital is an incredible partner in our efforts to serve victims in the community. At the university, we have counseling available for students. We always make referrals to AWARE for confidential resources through their advocates. And then we have a response system in place that should a student report, do an investigation into that report, and we look at making sure the behavior has stopped, that we're able to remedy the person who reported to us, and that we look for ways to prevent the assault from happening in the future, or more assaults from happening in the future.
Is the hunting ground for women only?
Oh, no. There are a wide number of really brave and amazing students who share their stories, men and women, and a large number of university administrators who talk about their experience as advocates for students and kind of the barriers they experience, men and women faculty and staff. It's a great discussion to have about college environments. We actually kind of are hoping to maybe attract parents who are sending their students to college, so high school seniors whose parents or the seniors themselves want to come out for this discussion, just so that students have an awareness when they hit their college campus, wherever they're going, to ask certain questions. How do I report if I'm concerned about myself or a friend? Britta talked earlier about bystander intervention. So much of how we can prevent these things from happening is to encourage people to seek help for others when they're concerned about others. So this is a community-wide conversation, men, women, parents, children, activists, advocates, anyone interested in having that conversation with us.
And the showing is next week?
It's this week, actually, this Thursday at 6:30 in the lecture hall, Egan Lecture Hall.
Anything you'd like to add before?
Yeah, as Lori mentioned, this is for men and women, as are AWARE services. And if you know of anybody or you yourself has been a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, be it a man, a woman, or whatever your sexual orientation, we invite you to call our crisis line at 586-1090. It's a confidential free service for anyone and everyone.
Is that AWARE's crisis line?
Yes.
All right, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 11th of April, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet Christopher Smart, born in Shipburn, England, 1722. He experienced a religious awakening and began praying in accordance with the biblical injunction to pray ceaselessly. He would fall to his knees whenever moved by the Spirit, which was an embarrassment to his family, and they put him into an asylum, where he wrote the two poems for which he is best known, A Song to David and Jubilate Agno. It's the birthday of the humorist Leo Rostin, born in Lodz, Poland, 1908. He was the editor of The Joys of Yiddish. It came out in 1968, a dictionary that described the 20 situations where one should say fe and 19 meanings of the word nu, and included entries on chutzpah and oi. It's the birthday of the writer Dorothy Allison, born Greenville, South Carolina, 1949, grew up desperately poor, the child of an unwed 15-year-old mother. She was abused by her stepfather, but her teachers inspired her to go on to college. She became the first person in her family to attend college. She wrote a memoir about her childhood, Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, and a novel, Bastard Out of Carolina. Dorothy Allison, who said, people want biography, people want memoir. They want you to tell them that the story you're telling them is true. And it's the birthday of the poet Mark Strand, born in Summerside, Prince Edward Island, Canada, 1934. His dad worked for Pepsi-Cola. The family moved across Canada and the United States down to Mexico, Cuba, Colombia, Peru. He went off to the Yale School of Art and Architecture, studied painting there, then decided his talent lay in writing. Spent a year in Florence, went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Over the next 15 years, published 7 collections of poetry, and then decided he was burned out. He wrote children's books for a time, a book of short stories called Mr. and Mrs. Baby and Other Stories, picked up a translation of The Iliad by Robert Fitzgerald, and was inspired to start writing again. Toward the end of his life, age of 77, he quit writing poetry. He'd fallen in love with a Spanish woman. He moved to Madrid, and he began making collages, he said, as an escape from making meaning. I got tired of writing poems, of trying to make sense. Here's a poem by Mark Strand entitled Nights in Hackett's Cove. Those nights lit by the moon and the moon's nimbus, the bones of the wrecked pier rose crooked in air, and the sea wore a tarnished coat of silver. The black pines waded the cold air, smelled of fish heads rotting under the pier at low tide. The moon kept shedding its silver clothes over the bogs and pockets of bracken. Those nights I would gaze at the bay road, at the cottages clustered under the moon's immaculate stare. Nothing hinted that I would suffer so late this turning away, this longing to be there. Nights in Hackett's Cove by Mark Strand from his new selected poems, published by Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com, and by Staples, with print solutions for small business, including copies, presentations, booklets, and custom-framed prints and posters. In-store and online, Staples make more happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about half past the hour in your Juno afternoon here. Listener supported KTO and KRNN FM. In the studio with me now is Peggy Metcalf, here to talk about the Pioneer Home Foundation and how you can be involved. Peggy, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here and let people know a little bit about the foundation. I didn't know about it until I was asked to be on the board. I didn't know there was such a thing, but it's been going since 1992, and it's formed to enhance the lives of the residents there. We do the things that the state cannot do. For instance, we bought computers, get them set up on internet, Netflix. We do special things at holidays. One thing we have coming up Friday is a party for the volunteers. And there are many volunteers.
Before we get too far into this, tell me a little bit about the Pioneer Home itself. People drive by it all the time, but a lot of people have never been inside.
Well, the Pioneer Home is very nice. It's very warm and welcoming, and it is like a home. It's run on the Eden program, so there are pets and plants. In the little kitchens at the end of some of the arms, they have some food cooking so that the smells from the food kind of help memories. Same with a music program that we've purchased that helps people remember, because the music is in a different part of the brain and they may not remember your name, but the music brings back good thoughts. The Pioneer Home is, as I said, very comfortable. There are things going on there all the time. Jackie Farnsworth plays music twice a week for an hour and a half, old songs, and sings, and pioneers sing with her and play instruments and keep time. There's bingo and games. There's crafts to do. There's a preschool there. Many of the seniors just like watching those little kids. And the kids like them. There's got a lot of grandma and grandpas there.
How many volunteers do you have at the Pioneer Home?
It fluctuates, but probably around 80. Some come maybe once a month. Some come once a week. Jackie comes twice a week, just depending upon the volunteer and what they do.
What kind of person makes the best kind of volunteer?
Well, I think it's someone who is very giving and loving, very forgiving for a lot of things, and just someone that you'd want as a friend, who's able to step in and do things for others and to take care of things when they see it needs to be done and to do it.
What about time commitments?
Time commitment kind of depends upon the volunteer. As I said, some are there very seldom and others are there all the time. So it just depends upon the personal time.
What kind of things do the volunteers get back from their service to the pioneers?
I think the main thing is satisfaction. You know, when you do something for somebody, it always makes you feel good. And that's the main thing that they come away with, is a good feeling.
And you're having a party this week to celebrate.
Yes, we are. We are. Dan DeRue designed a logo for the foundation, and we're putting that logo on a little pin. So we're giving our volunteers this little pin that has forget-me-nots and Juno Pioneer Home Foundation, or at least I'm not sure that's spelled out. I've seen just a small picture of the pin, so I've not really seen it yet. But I understand they're quite pretty.
And Andrew's a great artist.
Yeah, he is, and we were so lucky that he did it because his mother lived there. And so he did it because of that. He had a connection to the Pioneer Home.
What time does the party start?
Oh, we're going to start about 5 o'clock, and then 5:30 have some recognition. Just a short evening, just to honor the volunteers and for the volunteers to be together and see each other, and also for the residents to thank them.
How does one become a volunteer?
Well, just going to the Pioneer Home. Right now, Judy Neary is the activity director, and she is the one you'd contact. But she's retiring at the end of the month, so they're hopefully going to be looking for another one because it's a job that is needed. The executive director, Gina Delisario, can do just so much. You know, you have to have other people like Judy.
If people want to volunteer, who do they get in touch with? Just the Pioneer Home itself?
Yes, you can get in touch with the Pioneer Home, and I'm sure when Judy is not there, perhaps Lauren, who's the social worker, and she works directly with the families when they move into the Pioneer Home and with the families that, you know, belong to that person. And it may be her that they would go through. I don't know exactly how they're going to set it up when Judy leaves. It's going to leave a big hole. It's a big job with volunteers coming in every day. They have an ice cream social on Fridays. They have several there, and they always have games in the afternoon, and they have movies in the evening. And there's always the residents that just like to visit. And sometimes they'll structure a little get together, and there's so much history at the Pioneer Home. People who have done so many things. Peter Bibb is one. Often he'll have a group, and then he can talk and tell what he did about the ski club and how they used to go Dan Moeller and, you know, from the very beginning, before Eagle Crest.
But how many volunteers at the Pioneer Home? Not in the volunteers, how many pioneers?
Oh, there's about 40. There's 40 rooms, and that's at capacity.
I know there's a long waiting line.
Yes, there is. So, if you think you might want to go to the Pioneer Home one day, and you reach 65, you better sign up.
Maggie Metcalf, thanks for coming by and talking about
Well, this. I'm so glad that I got to visit with you, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. On the phone with me now is Roger Schmidt from the Sitka Fine Arts Camp and also the Sitka Arts and Science Festival. Roger, thank you for coming down today on the station.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get too much further, tell me a little bit about Roger Schmidt. You've been a longtime person there in Sitka as far as the fine arts go. And you play the trombone, is that correct?
That's right. I'm a trombonist. I went to the Fine Arts Camp when I was a student. In middle school and high school, and I've been the executive director of the Fine Arts Camp now for 16 years. And we started with about 40 students when my first year teaching, and now last summer we served just shy of 800 students.
800 students? How do you deal with them all?
Not all at once, but with a lot of great help and a lot of great staff, and the best way we deal with them is by making great programs that they love so much that it makes it easy for us and everyday fun.
Now, what is the Arts and Science Festival?
I think the best way to describe it is, for many years now, people have been asking us when we're going to have an adult fine arts camp and something that is allows people to come from out of town, that has a sort of all-day programming, that has evening programming, and provides an immersive experience for people who are older than our normal crowd, which is elementary through high school. And what it is we partnered with our favorite science organization and campus partner at the Sheldon Jackson campus, and that's the Sitka Science Center. And they're making a name for themselves by creating just fantastic scientific exploration and programs, and then we're combining it with our arts world to have a Festival of Arts and Sciences, and it's a series of workshops. People can sign up for individual workshops from renowned, extraordinary both Alaskan artists and scientists, and then artists and scientists who come from all over the country. And then in addition to classes, different sort of outdoor exploration activities through the lens of arts and sciences. And then in the evening, there's presentations and performances by artists and scientists. And each session is 1 week long.
Can you describe some of the classes, please?
Yeah, sure. We have the first session, which is July 16th through July 23rd. We have four artist scientists. Molly Weisenberg, she's a food writer who both of her most recently published books were New York Times bestsellers. She just got the James Beard Award for writing. She's going to be doing a workshop on writing about place, which is something that really matters a lot to her. Rob Dunbar is a professor of earth sciences at Stanford University, and he's doing a workshop on the landforms and seascapes of Baranof Island and Sitka Sound. He calls the song he calls his workshop Fire and Ice, because it's looking at how those two things have shaped our landscape and seascape. I'm just sort of going through week one.
How many weeks are there?
There's 2 weeks, and each one is a distinct week. Clark Mishler I think that most Alaskans either know Clark by name, or they know him by his images. If they don't actually know his name, then pretty much all of us have seen his great photography. He's been capturing Alaska landscapes and Alaska people for many years, and his clients include Alaska Magazine, Alaska Airlines, National Geographic, places like, publications like those. And then Terry Rothkar is our local Sitka, Alaska a weaver, and she's a national treasure, one of the leading authorities on Tlingit weaving. She's also really interested in the science behind it, and also the science of how DNA affects her work with mountain goats, and what you can learn from looking at the old artwork and the materials. And so it's a really, really neat kind of collection of people and topics. Those are a few people who are coming.
Cool.
And a few of the different workshops.
Who should go?
Anybody. What we find at the Fine Arts Camp, and I guess why we sort of see this as adult Fine Arts Camp, is that when people stop and take time for themselves, and they do it in a way that where they're getting to explore not only sort of the world but their own creativity and be around others, it's incredibly inspiring, and it's something that people don't take enough time to do, and it makes everything better. So it's anybody who's an adult, anybody 18 to 100 should come be part of this, and it'll be very stimulating, very fun, very interesting. We have participants coming from around the country. We have local participants from Alaska signed up for it, and I think it's a great way to meet people, and in a way that really, I mean, that's the best way to sort of spend time with people is making, thinking, and exploring.
What about housing?
We provide it on the campus. The whole program is located on the historic Sheldon Jackson campus, which is most folks in Juneau will be familiar with. It's actually gorgeous. It's a National Historic Landmark campus, and it's been home of the single largest grassroots volunteer effort in the history of Alaska we've had since we took ownership of the majority of the campus. We've had almost 1,000 people put 40,000 or more hours of volunteer time into the campus, and that was and that's been going on for 5 years. So it's a gorgeous location. It's a gorgeous facility, and it's also sort of the home of its own sort of exciting grassroots revitalization. And also historically, it's one of the most important. It's the oldest educational institute in Alaska, and its own history and legacy has had a huge impact on our state.
What about cost?
Cost is, let's see, I'm going to look that up. I believe that, hold on. Tuition is, it's about $1,000 to come to it. And that includes your housing, includes your tuition, includes your food. So it's a great deal.
And how do people sign up for it?
They go to sitkafestival.org, and or they just can go right to sitkafestival.org, or they can just Google Sitka Arts and Sciences, or they can Google Sitka Fine Arts Camp, and all those places will lead them there. Or they can call me or our office at 707-747-3085.
Sounds like a fun time for all.
I think it's our first year. We were fortunate to get funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. They're really excited about this theme of arts and sciences. They're really excited about things sort of community projects that, in this case, are really exploring what it means to live in Alaska or to visit Alaska. And so it's a project with that grant funding, we were able to get it off the ground and launch it this year, and we're hoping it's something that will continue into perpetuity.
Well, Sitka's got so many creative people involved in all aspects of the community. It sounds like a must-do.
Yeah, I think so, and it fits with really kind of what we've been building here, and it's a natural extension to the work of the Sitka Fine Arts Camp and the work of the Sitka Sound Science Center.
I've been talking with Roger Schmidt, who works with the Sitka Arts and Science Festival in Sitka. Tell me again the dates.
Yes, it is. The first session is July 16th to 23rd, and the second session is July 23rd to 30th.
Roger, thank you for being on the air with me today.
Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure.
This is Bird Note. It's before dawn on a spring day in the big cypress swamp of Florida. Mist is rising from quiet water into Spanish moss hanging from the cypress branches. Suddenly, a startling sound breaks the silence. A male limpkin has awakened. This relatively tall bird, whose dark brown feathers are streaked with white, stretches and calls again. In the distance, a red-shouldered hawk responds. The limpkin hops down from its perch and begins probing the dark water with its long bill. It's foraging for apple snails, each the size of a golf ball. When it touches a big round shell, it grabs it quickly and pulls it from the water. Then, moving to solid ground, the limpkin positions the shell and, using the curved tip of its lower mandible, it scissors loose the operculum, the door that closes the shell, and pulls out the snail. One quick swallow, and it's on to find the rest of breakfast. By this time, other birds have awakened, and Carolina wrens and white-eyed vireos are declaring their territories. A pig frog adds to the amphibian and avian chorus of the big cypress swamp. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, featuring a final open skate on Sunday, April 17th from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. This skate is open to the public with complimentary admission and skates. More information available at 586-0410 or online at juno.org/parkrec/icerink.
About 10 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guest comes to us by the magic of telephone. Peter Bradley is here from the Island Institute. Peter, thanks for coming on the show with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
So we're talking about the Island Institute. Could you give me an idea what it is, please?
Yeah, absolutely. The Island Institute has been in operation since 1984, and its primary focus is on fostering explorations of how people live together well in community, and what that means, and how people live together well as part of broader natural systems. And so it's this interesting and fairly unique mix of community and environment and where they come together. And so this year, we're focusing our efforts on understanding the link between community and environment in the specific question of how Southeast Alaskans are experiencing climate change and what are the implications of the changing climate on their culture and community.
Peter, a little bit about your background, please.
Sure. My personal background is in radio, actually. I I was the music director of a radio station for a time in Ontario, Canada. But then somewhere, and then the station manager of that radio station. And then at some point I traveled up to Alaska and bicycled down from Whitehorse to Haines and took the ferry over to Sitka. And I fell in love with this place. I come from a place where I was surrounded by farmland and the trees grow in straight rows. And, I was blown away, by the beauty of the place and by the tight-knit sense of community in the towns that I visited, and by the sort of rabid eloquence that the people I met had in describing their experience of the place and of the nature around them and their place in it. And so with all of that, I looked one day to see if I could find my way up here, and this incredible opportunity at the Allen Institute was there waiting for me.
Who is it for?
For a long time, it was for people particularly interested in. It's for anybody interested in exploring those themes, really, and who are sort of striving to understand or find language for their experience of place and community, but it's often been a place for literary folks. A lot of our programs have a literary bent, particularly the longer standing of the Allen Institute's programs. But these days we're also running, we're sort of opening our focus a bit more. We have a new program called the Sitka Story Lab, which is for students ages 7 through 18, creative writing and storytelling program. And on this trip, we're sort of working with, we have four artists coming through, and so this trip is for them. This trip is also for the people that we're interacting with in the community as we spark these conversations that as we go through these towns, it's clear that these are subjects that people are sort of itching to have space and time and structure to talk around.
Tell me more about the Allen Institute. You're traveling around various communities in Southeast Alaska.
That's right, yeah. Right now we're on our Tidelines Ferry Tour. We started at the beginning of April in Sitka, and we've traveled through Wrangell and Ketchikan and Cake as well. Now I'm sitting in Petersburg, and we have four artists who are dealing with climate change themes in their work. And one of the artists will switch out for another at the time of our Juno stop. So we have Chantal Bilodeau, a playwright from New Jersey, who's writing an Arctic cycle of full-length plays, one set in each of the Arctic countries. We have Michelle Kunset-Fung, who is a drawing-based artist who's expanding her sort of repertoire, and she's imagining an unfortunate future where the world is sort of drowned in plastics in 2084. We have Heather Powell, a Thlinkit culture bearer and language warrior, and she's traveling with two high school students and her three kids, bringing some perspective of the sort of traditional ecological knowledge systems and how a lot of important ideas about this area are contained in that language and culture. And then we're traveling with Allison Warden, who grew up in Juneau and who has family roots in Kaktovik, and she's a performance artist and rapper.
Do you have a different schedule for each community?
Yeah, in each community where we have the artists do a performance and we host a community conversation. And so in Juneau, on the 14th, we arrive in the morning, and then that evening from 7 to 8:30 at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, who are our partner for this visit, we'll host a long table conversation, and we invite everybody to join us. The format for that will offer a few primer questions that will sort of get at people's experience of climate change in Juneau, and people can sort of move from the audience section to the table section as they desire. So if they want to be actively part of the conversation, they can, but if they want to step back and sit out and listen, then that's an option too. So it should be a great conversational format for this topic. It's a bit different than what we've been doing in the other communities. And then on the evening of the 17th from 7 to 9, also at the JAC, we have our artist performances, and at that point in the tour, Terry Rothkar will be joining us. She's a Tlingit weaver and storyteller. And so that will be a chance for people to see and experience the work that the artists are doing.
What would you say the mission statement for the Inland Institute might be?
It's to foster and explore resilient community through creative writing, through storytelling, through conversation.
Cool. How do people get in touch with you to sign up?
Yeah, people can reach out to me by writing to peter@iialaska.org. People can show up at the door, and people can visit our website at iialaska.org. And specifically for Tidelines, just add /Tidelines to that.
I've been talking with Peter Bradley about the Inland Institute. Peter, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, thank you. Thank you so much for hosting us on your program. We're excited to visit Juneau and hope people will stop by. Oh, one thing though is if any teachers are listening in who would like to have us have any of our sort of constituent parts on this tour meet up with your classroom group, please do reach out. We're happy to do classroom visits. So again, that's peter@iialaska.org.
Peter, thanks so much for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Almost twice as many Alaska Natives are exposed to secondhand smoke and aerosols in their workplace than non-Natives. Secondhand smoke contributes to preventable illness and premature death. Smoke-free policies protect the public's health, discourage people from starting, and help people quit tobacco. 118 Alaskan tribes have passed comprehensive tobacco-free tribal resolutions. If your tribe wants to join this movement, contact Search at 364-4452. This message is brought to you by Search and the Partnership for Tobacco-Free Southeast.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 874.